There are no page numbers.
Yeah, that's where the top secret stamps were. My source had to cut them off.
We're supposed to retire on Friday.
Ben, how are we supposed to comb through 4,000 pages?
They're not even loosely organized.
The Times had 3 months. There's no way we can possibly
He's
get
right.
this
We got less than 8 hours.
This is a pivotal scene from The Post, a movie starring Tom Hanks that takes us back to 1971, when The Washington Post made the bold decision to publish stories based on the Pentagon Papers, despite pressure from the highest levels of government not to.
There's dozens of stories in here. The Times has barely scratched the surface. We have 10 hours till the deadline, so we dig in.
Anna Webber, who worked on the movie, was on set when that scene was being filmed, and yes, it made her think about history and the role of journalism in speaking truth to power, but it also made her think about her dad, who worked as a newspaper man for the Kansas City Star for decades. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show begins with Anna Webber's reflections on the newsroom, from her observations as a young girl to the research that made it possible to recreate that environment on screen. Hi, Anna.
Hi, good morning.
So for those who haven't seen the movie or read that much about it, can you give us the quick and dirty synopsis of The Post?
Sure. It's the story of Katharine Graham, who was the publisher of the Washington Post during that era, and her editor, Ben Bradley, and their quest to kind of move the Washington Post from being more of a local paper to a national paper with a lot of clout behind it. And when the Pentagon Papers story was published by the New York Times, they were really jealous, and it was a big coup for the Times and made the Post realize that they were missing out on things. But then the government put a ton of pressure on the New York Times, ended up shutting down their publication, and the Washington Post realized that that created an opportunity for them to kind of step up and really make a name for themselves and also share these papers that they felt like the American public had a right to read.
So, yeah.
Go ahead.
Recreating the visual atmosphere of an old newsroom was kind of the crux of your work on The Post. Is that right?
Yeah, I was an art department coordinator, and I worked very closely with the production designer, art directors, and our team that built the sets, recreated them, the ones from history, and kind of tried to capture the look and feel of that era and the feel of the energy that we wanted to make such an important part of the movie.
So how did you go about doing that, and how did memories of your dad, who worked at the Kansas City Star, play into it?
It was definitely a whirlwind. The whole movie came together very quickly. We kind of jumped directly into the research phase, talking to as many people as we could who had memories from that time, going through all of the photos, all of the online research we could find, and then also going to some archives and trying to pull research from there. For me, and I think the movie making process in general is a little bit of a romanticized one. We always want to try and be true to history whenever possible, but we're also trying to communicate a very particular story. It really comes down to the storytelling more than anything else. And so even on screen, our newsrooms is a little bit of a romanticized view of the newsroom, which for me felt really resonant because my experiences growing up with my dad working at the Kansas City Star, I saw his life and the newsroom there through a child's eyes in a lot of ways. And so it's sort of through nostalgia and my romanticized memories that I have the kind of visceral memories of the piles of paper everywhere and of the phones ringing and of the sound of the typewriters before the computers totally took over. And that kind of energy, I think, really does translate through the movie as well.
One of my favorite descriptions of a newsroom comes from a woman who worked as a journalist in the early 20th century, but I think this still rings true. Part monastery, part slaughterhouse.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I haven't heard that, but it's totally true. And in a lot of ways, it reminds me of the movie making process, too. It can be a lot of waiting and waiting and waiting and then go, 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 go.
What are some of your favorite little visual details? You write in an essay in Catapult about the pneumatic tube system, which kind of intrigued me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the In 1971, the Washington Post newsroom and the entire paper production process was kind of at a fun point because modernization was just starting to catch up, but it wasn't quite there. They were about to move to the newsroom that we see in All the President's Men, where it's really colorful and everything, but hadn't quite yet. So there were still some vestiges of older newspaper making that were still there, like the linotype machines that you see in the movies. And then there are also these pneumatic tube systems. So rather than having a courier or someone have to run down to, you know, many flights of stairs to wherever the editors might be or where the presses actually were, they had these massive pneumatic tube systems, which in my personal experience, the only thing I can really relate them to is kind of like what you would get at a bank drive-in sort of thing, except on a massive scale.
So that was like email.
It was. It was like, you know, kind of like a very rudimentary email that to get things from one building to another as quickly as possible. Because, of course, you know, when news is breaking, every second can count. And they want to make sure that everyone who needs to get their eyes on something can. And it just it goes fast. Every little thing they can do to make it faster. So we recreated those tubes in the newsroom, and it's great because there's a couple good shots of them. It adds a lot of fun energy to it.
The smoking in the newsroom is also kind of a fun detail, and I loved reading in your essay about what those actors are smoking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, studios don't really like to show people smoking in movies anymore. They really do put a lot of effort into trying to promote healthier lifestyles, even when characters may not go along with it. But with something like this, you couldn't avoid the fact that everybody in those newsrooms back in the 70s were all smoking like chimneys just constantly. And so they pretty early on were like, okay, we get it. They need to be smoking. So we had we knew, for example, what kind of cigarettes Ben Bradley tended to smoke more often. But obviously, they're shooting on set hours and hours. They don't want them to have to smoke one cigarette, let alone the 20 or 30 that it would take to get the shot done. So our props department pretty laboriously replaced the packaging. So they replaced all of the real cigarettes with herbal ones and had just hundreds and hundreds of packs of fake cigarettes that looked real on set for the actors to smoke.
Tom Hanks might be currently addicted to like lavender and oregano cigarettes.
I know, right? I know. They do kind of smell good. So even just walking around set, it's a little like, all right, it's not nearly as vile as I imagine it probably would have been with real tobacco filling.
But back to the tie-in with your memories of your dad. I mean, you got this job recreating the Washington Post newsroom on screen almost exactly 1 year after losing your dad, who worked at the Kansas City Star as a newspaper man. And you use that term really deliberately. Can you talk about that term, newspaper man?
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, my dad's relationship, at least through my perception of it, it was really complicated with the newspaper industry. We tend to really romanticize it in a lot of ways, but a lot of times his job was really bureaucratic or required a lot of, just like little, there weren't so many big Pentagon paper stories, I guess. But there's something about the energy in those newsrooms that I think was really addicting for people who found homes there, who found that they really belong. So on the day-to-day, they might grumble about, what the work that they're doing or the type of stories that they have to cover. But when they try to separate themselves from it, it seems impossible. I think that was definitely true for my dad in a lot of ways. It's sort of like as soon as he thought about not doing that kind of work, it all of the nostalgia and memories and all of the energy and all of the people that he worked with through the years kind of came flooding back, and he realized that that was just such a part of his identity, that really unique culture, that really unique mission to kind of tell stories. And in the later years of his life, he definitely loved to tell us stories about it. So it was fun because we got to hear little glimpses that we didn't necessarily either hear or understand when we were kids actually visiting the newsroom.
Did one of those stories come flashing back to you in the course of working on the Post?
Oh, man, I think a lot did.
Can you tell us one of them?
I have to try and think of one that's appropriate. there's always that that edge to the news stories. I do know my dad followed quite a bit with the government. At one point, he was moved to the Kansas Bureau and was doing stuff with the Kansas government. And I know that there he felt like there was always a real challenge of trying to translate the sort of bureaucracy that was going on the government level into a way of communicating it to a local audience who probably isn't very well versed in government.
Like the jargon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I definitely remember having conversations with him where he's like, I don't remember exactly what it was at the time, but, you know, say, for example, a tax code is going to have a massive effect on daily lives. How do we tell people this in a way that they'll actually understand? Because when you lay it all out, it seems very boring and kind of dry. And then, of course, there are always little scandals, too. I think anytime you have an industry like that where people have to connect with other people on a really personal level, sometimes you have reporters who have to kind of navigate the line between getting to know sources, being sympathetic to sources, and also kind of maintaining their journalistic integrity and the objective point of view. And I know that came up from time to time as well.
Has working on this movie, I mean, your dad was let go in one of those brutal waves of layoffs. And yeah. I wonder if working on this movie made you think differently. I mean, not just about the trajectory of your dad's career at the Kansas City Star, but about the trajectory of journalism.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, the making of the movie itself was definitely a deliberate act. It didn't exist at the beginning of February, basically. There was a spec script written by
February 2017.
Yep. This last year. Yeah. And an unproduced screenwriter named Liz Hanna wrote a script. It ended up landing. She was trying to get an agent. She wasn't expecting it to get produced. And it happened to land on the right desk where an assistant or someone along those lines picked it up, read it, passed it on to the producer, Amy Pascal, who was really interested in making a sort of timely political movie. And she realized that the political climate last year, this was exactly the kind of story that really needed to be told, and passed it on to Spielberg. And you know, almost literally overnight, the major pieces of the puzzle came together. And within weeks, I was getting a phone call asking if I could come and work on it. And days after that, we were in the office working. And everybody knew throughout the entire process that this was not a normal movie in a way. Sometimes our work on the movie can be very removed from the end product. But on this, we knew that this meant something, that it was really about the current political climate, and that it had several stories in it, both about the press and about women's roles in business and society that really needed to be told right now. And for my dad, as someone who had really thrived in the newspaper industry for a long time and really had an opportunity to kind of see it in towards the tail end of what you might call the glory days, before the internet really took over, I definitely watched him navigate those changes. And in a lot of ways, it wasn't necessarily an incredibly sad thing for him. I think he was excited to see how things were going to change, and he was very aware of some of the mistakes that newspapers and the people who govern newspapers made during that time in terms of not really realizing how their papers functioned as a business. And he survived rounds and rounds and rounds and rounds and rounds of layoffs over the course of many years before the axe finally fell for him. So he was a little resigned to it by the time it happened. But in making this movie about sort of the timeliness of having a powerful press that can really tell a story in a in-depth way, that it's not a surface reporting, it's really sort of doing serious work, bringing lots of resources together to sort of dive into a story, it still has a lot of resonance today. And I think he would have appreciated that. He would have liked that message a lot.
Yeah, you say you wish he was here in 2017 to see that people still care about the stories newsrooms tell and care about the stories that happen in those newsrooms themselves. And it does seem like there's a growing, like, general awareness of what's at stake, at least, in the work journalists do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially on the local level, too, which is one of the reasons why it was really great to think about my dad in Kansas City. I had been away from Kansas City for several years, or have been away from Kansas City for several years in terms of living. But I love to go back and visit. And I feel like the city has such a personality. And the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times, when it still had the evening paper, were such centerpieces of that community. And nowadays, there's still amazing reporting happening. I never want to, like, discount work a lot of really amazing journalists and editors and other publishers and things like that are doing. But a lot of that's happening through the internet, or it's happening through these sort of globalized entities. And you don't really get that super localized community, like, cornerstone quite as much anymore. Like, I feel, you know, my nostalgic view of the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times definitely puts it in that place where it was, where everybody got their news for so many different levels, for their immediate local news, their national news, their international news. But it also was kind of a coming together place where community events were shared, and it was a common cultural touchstone for people.
Yeah.
And it reflected the unique nature of the city.
Yeah. Thinking back on that nostalgia, can you talk just a little bit more before we go about your memories of being in that newsroom?
Yeah.
As a child.
I mentioned, like, the piles of paper. That was definitely one of it. I was definitely the kind of kid that thrived on drama a little bit. So I was always really excited when it would be, I don't know if it was closer to deadline or what the situations were, but I remember there being certain times when it'd be really quiet in there. And then there'd be certain times where it was just like this visceral energy running through the place, with people darting about and phones ringing and this sense of urgency that, you know, that nowadays, like I said, really does kind of translate to the film industry too, because we operate on a very similar sort of rhythm.
Yeah.
But just this real energy and this sense of collaboration too. I just remember, I grew up hearing stories about all the people that Dad worked with, and they were always a major part of his life. I'd hear names over and over and over again. At his funeral in 2016, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of people whose names I had heard over the years, because he just would always tell stories about the work that his colleagues were doing, the projects they were working on together. And it just really added to the romance of all of it and to my memories of what the newspaper room meant for him.
Anna Weber, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you too. It was great talking to you.
Anna worked in the art department for The Post, starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, and her dad was Kirk Weber of the Kansas City Star. If you look closely, you might notice a tribute to him visually in The Post. Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, parents of children with special needs work hard to find great opportunities for their kids in school systems. So how do the schools measure up? Share your stories and insights after this break. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to take a look at where we are as a metro when it comes to helping kids of all ability types to thrive in school. Our culture has come a long way in terms of acceptance and acknowledgement. Have the educational opportunities and has the educational research followed suit? What are the ongoing challenges for families trying to find a great school for their kids with special needs? Call 816-235-2888 with your story and your perspective. We've got two guests who can talk first about the research, then what's going on locally. For the research, I'm going to start with Sarah Otto Wren. She teaches classes in special education at UMKC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So first of all, when we talk about special education, who is that for exactly? I mean, it seems like that term is a little vague and maybe deliberately so.
Yes. Well, it's definitely a broad term, but special education is by federal law under IDEA, and that is a law that protects individuals ages 3 through up to 21 in the public school setting. So that is when we're talking about special education, that's who is predominantly protected under it, but then that will also vary as we're looking into private school options, and then what do those special services look like when somebody might have an exceptional learning need and want to go to post-secondary options and colleges.
Okay, so 3 to 21 is the age range, but help me understand, first of all, the range of ability, the range of abilities that that covers, and then also the range of, I don't know, states and the country's obligations to those students.
Well, great. So IDEA covers 13 different categories of disability, and that can be autism, learning disability, speech, language impairment, hearing impairment, a variety of things that way. And what we're looking at is just because you might have a diagnosis of autism, you actually also have to show a deficit in your learning, whether that be your social, emotional, and behavioral in a school setting compared to your age equivalent peers, or whether that's also academic performance, communication performance, all of those things. And so there has to be an evaluation because we don't want to just put a label on a child or put another label on a child without making sure that we have all the evaluation and information to truly make sure that we can adjust that child's educational program to meet their specific learning needs.
So what is it that has to be observed? Because it sounds like on the one hand, you want to be careful not to inappropriately label a child, which I totally understand. But on the other hand, if that label is what gets that child extra help or attention, then the label can feel to a family maybe like a positive thing or even a necessary thing. What is it that a student has to show demonstrably in a classroom setting?
Great. Well, what a child has to show is that with interventions in place, we have this whole movement now called RTI, which is a response to intervention. And that is saying, okay, this child is not performing at grade level with their peers. I'm going to try this first round of interventions that I can do in my general education classroom to see if that brings the student up. And then when you're doing those interventions, you're really just changing that child's access to the information. You're not really changing a level of it, but you're providing, whether it be additional support to help them master a content. Maybe they just need a little bit more specialized one-on-one or specific instruction. Or you may be breaking it up, giving them different breaks, addressing some physical activity or their sensory need for a lot of motion, things like that. So
you said RTI. What is that?
That is a response to intervention. And that is kind of the process that if a parent or a teacher is having a concern about a child's ability to perform at grade level and meet the core standards, then the teacher can start this process of specific interventions that the team is going to try in the general education setting before we do an evaluation and determine if the learning deficit is significantly below peers. So that would be like more than two standard deviations below kind of a normed test standard.
This sounds very sort of methodical and like checking off boxes, but on the human level, help me understand how, you know, how families and schools navigate these things together, because it does seem like the range of needs and abilities is very wide, and every school is just one school. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. So every school is just one school, but they're all part of their school district. So even though you may not have a specific person at that school that you know of that is in charge of managing these special services and what this process of evaluation looks like, the school district is got people placed strategically around covering a variety of schools. So, for example, a school psychologist might not be just at one school. They might have 6 to 8 to 10 schools that they are managing and going along this process. I think for families, if you do have a concern, the first thing you have to do is contact the teacher and say, I'm having a concern. Are you seeing this at school? Is there anything I should be doing at home to help?
So it starts with the parent?
It can start with the parent or the teacher. Sometimes a parent may think that they're seeing a deficit in different settings and the teacher may not see it at school. But either one of them can initiate the process to go through this review process of determining if the child is having an exceptional learning need. Are there underlying circumstances, or are there things that we just need to provide an intervention to help them access what they are learning?
So what are some of the newer trends when it comes to helping students access what they're learning? Are the best practices changing a lot in this field?
I think that we are increasing our best practices through better teacher education during their undergrad and graduate school programs. And we are teaching teachers how to reach a more diverse population of learners. Before, we kind of used to just, 20 years ago, we used to just kind of teach to the middle group. And that left out the students that were performing higher than grade level and left out the students performing lower than grade level. And now there's a big focus on differentiating. And so planning for those learners that have those exceptional learning needs, both at the bottom and the top of the bell curve, if you want to think about it that way. And if I can plan in my instruction to include those students in my lesson plan, I'm not only hitting the middle, but I'm also hitting the high and the low ends there. And so we talk about differentiation. We talk about universal design for learning. You'll hear those words, and that's making sure that we are reaching all of our learners in our plans.
I'm guessing that part of the goal has to do with not just teaching the curriculum itself and like grade level performance type stuff, but also the social aspects of school. I mean, helping kids thrive, not just on report cards, but in the school environment, thrive with their peers.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So we do try to focus on that social, emotional, and behavioral development. I think that probably in the last 20 years, there's been a great demand placed on our schools as far as making sure that we are performing at a certain level across the country. And so we do feel the pressure of meet the standard as teachers in the classroom. And we have to remember that, our kids are not just empty banks that we can throw information at and fill up and they're going to get it and they're going to perform. And so that's part of the, making sure that we diversify our strategies to reach all the learners and that we differentiate the various levels in order to get a common goal mastered.
What else is being talked about in these circles a lot? Like, what is sort of, if you are talking to the teachers you instruct or families in schools, like, what are some of the concerns that you will hear over and over again right now?
I think behaviors are usually one of the biggest concerns I hear both from a teacher standpoint and from a parent standpoint, not knowing how to manage them. And that goes back once again, like you said, to teaching that social, emotional, and behavioral regulation to students and how to manage those things. I think that behaviors are, especially if they involve, the whole body, falling out of your chair, running around, hitting, those are really extreme things that you can see. And I think that we almost get reactive when we see that, and we have to make sure that we hold on to our center and that we look at, why did that student do that? What are they asking for with this behavior? And what do I need to do so they don't get to that point?
I want to bring someone else in on this conversation. Tiffany Arrington is a psychologist who works with schools and parents to implement strategies for kids with special needs. And she's also a parent working on this stuff at home. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
I understand that you got your start working with college students in residence halls.
Yes, that was quite a story. That was my first experience in education, is seeing what students brought from home as they moved into residence halls.
And brought from their K to 12 education.
Yes, absolutely. That, and so I really do think about that as kind of my base, because, and I will talk to parents about when they go off to college and kind of set that scene for them, or when they finish high school, what's next. So it really was a great kind of frame.
So when you think about what's changed in the time that you've been working in special education as a counselor and as a parent, what comes to mind?
I think the thing that I see both as a parent and as a professional is this assumption that the school is going to provide information about where the child is, either developmentally or socially, just that it's going to volunteer that information. And for a lot of reasons, the school might not be in a position to do that.
Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So I don't
So if I'm a parent, mm-hmm. and there's something going on with my kid, I can't expect the school to tell me about it?
Not always. I think that the school... And I don't fault the school for this. I think that the school has a very difficult task. And if something is happening, the school is going to intervene, but they are going to alert the parents at the point that they feel like their interventions are not effective. I'm thinking like behaviorally,
that's kind of wild. The school's going to be like tackling a problem that possibly a parent doesn't know even exists.
And it's possible. I think that varies from schools to schools, and from the experience that the teacher has. I think some teachers are very comfortable just building relationships with families and having those informal conversations. And then some teachers, maybe because of their preparation, have had it drilled into them. They are not, clinicians. They are not diagnosticians. That's not their role. They shouldn't speculate. And I respect that, maybe they're not comfortable having those conversations with parents.
So that's something that's changed, you say?
I think so, because when I speak to parents, they have this idea about school that they experienced when they were growing up, when teachers or administrators were a lot more forthcoming with, with comments or expectations. Maybe there was a more of a unified social expectation. That's iffy. But yes, they expected that the school was going to tell them what they needed to do for their child.
And that's not...
It's not always the case. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. So I think that's something for parents to be aware of, is that if they have anything that they're concerned about, that they should build a relationship with their child's teacher and ask those questions. Don't wait for, the no news is good news.
Can you give me an example of a situation where something was going on with a student that the teacher... for whatever reason, and maybe you can shed light on this, didn't feel comfortable sharing with the family?
Oh, my goodness. I have lots of examples that come to mind. The most immediate probably would be with my own child when his kindergarten year, he had been having some trouble behaviorally. And we knew that because the principal would call home. But when I was having a conversation with his teacher, I found out that he was falling out of his seat in kindergarten. And some people might think, well, what is that? For me, when I go into classrooms and do observations and I see a child fall out of their seat, that's like a tell.
A tell of what?
That they've got a lot of physical energy, some hyperactivity. It can be a very pretty significant symptom given everything else of attention problems. And so I was dialoguing with the teacher saying, wait, there's no earthquake, nobody's walking by, nothing's wrong with the seat. He's just falling out. And I'm having this reaction of, because I know what that means. And then I say, how often is this happening? And he's saying, well, it happens at least once a week. And I'm having some emotion with him. And then he says, well, there's a limit to what I can say.
Why?
Because he's not a doctor. He's not a clinician. He's not a trained mental health professional. But saying those words, I literally said to him, I know what that means. I've had to say that, you know, to parents. And we're, you know, it was all in good, you know, good spirits because we had had a good relationship with that teacher. So that's an example of sometimes the language is very nuanced. And, you know, I kind of talk about the code. He talked about the code of there's a limit to what I can say. You know,
are there other sort of coded exchanges around this stuff?
I have seen a lot of educators, and I don't fault this for at all. I've seen educators really have a difficult time talking about social emotional skills. Because they are less defined in our society. And
like what?
Inability to have reciprocal relationships, kids who are only playing their way, kids who are maybe spinning, kids who are doing repetitive things. All of those symptoms that, you know, sort of like on the, you know, on the private side, we would think, okay, you know, we're looking at some kind of developmental delay, and maybe we're a little bit more comfortable talking about that. I think that a teacher is in a position to, you know, to not, I don't know what this is, and I don't know what to say. And so they just kind of, they do their best. And again, I don't.
So what are some of the code words to listen for parents who might be listening to this?
Oh, that's a really tough question. I would say build a relationship with your child's teacher. I am very impressed with general education and special education teachers. They work really hard. I would say listen for what they don't say. Listen for the pauses.
Huh. Well, what are your biggest concerns for kids with special needs in local schools right now?
My concerns would be about the secondary aspects of special education in middle and high school. I think in elementary, I think the research is a lot more solid in that there are very concrete interventions to build reading capacity and math capacity and writing. And we're building specific skills. I think in the secondary level, the curriculum deepens. It becomes a lot more abstract, and it's difficult to really teach those thinking skills.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'd love to hear from you at 816-235-2888 about your struggle to find the right educational setting for your child. We'll also get some insight into recent news that the Shawnee Mission School District has been cited for falling short on providing federally required services to some students with disabilities. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's next. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about best practices in special education and how and whether they're being implemented in schools. My guests are Tiffany Arrington, who works with schools and families to navigate these things, and Sarah Otto Wren, who teaches special education at UMKC. Hi again, you guys.
Hi.
Now, we were just talking about coded language and that parents are sort of on this learning curve that the school isn't just going to necessarily tell them things. What are some of the other coded things that you might listen for?
In meetings that I've been in with parents and school districts, they'll present a lot of information. And some of those coded words or coded language might be that, well, we don't know if we can meet her needs in this setting, or teachers have different certifications for mild, moderate versus more functional and adapted curriculums. And so they may say that, well, our teacher is spending so much time, you know, managing your child's needs, and that's time that's pulled away from other students' needs. And so we may not have the right setting here, but our district would in a different setting. But listening to kind of those where we don't think we can meet those specific needs here, we think we've tried every intervention we can, those are codes that they may want to suggest a different special education placement or support program to better meet that child's needs and increase their academic progress.
So this brings up the question of, just from the outside, it seems like there has been maybe a little bit of a movement away from pulling kids out of the sort of mainstream educational setting and toward integration. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about that, Tiffany?
Absolutely. So I have a great, just a brief little story.
Yeah, please.
I was talking with a parent one time, and in the role as a school psychologist and a special education team, and really explaining that the school would like to propose service. And he had a really strong reaction to this idea, and I was listening hard to him, and then I realized this is about the definition of special education, and I had to say, wait a minute, what do you think that I am saying? And you know, he interpreted what I was saying as his daughter was pretty significantly impaired and going to be with quote unquote those kids, and I said, okay, special education is no longer the room in the back of the school. It is a service. And
can you explain how that works? Especially with phrases being thrown around like, we cannot serve this child in this setting.
I'm actually going to look to Sarah for that one. I think that she can explain it better.
Yeah. So special education is a service, and it's a continuum of services. And so you have a least restrictive service, which is in the general education classroom in that natural learning setting. And then depending on the needs and if interventions or teachers can't go in and support the needs there, there may be some more restrictive settings where I'm pulling you out for 20 minutes to do intensive reading or intensive math, or I'm pulling you out longer, or there's different settings that are more restrictive, and they're going to be more of a life skills adapted functional, where the actual level of the curriculum is going to change. It's going to be more of a modified curriculum, alternative state standards compared to the general education setting. And so those are kind of this, the continuum of what it is. But special education is a service, and we do try to provide as much education in the natural context of learning. We don't want students to think they can't learn with their peers when they get pulled out. And so there has been a movement towards inclusion. The more that we know, the more that we try. And it's important to remember that it's not just a place, that it's just the amount of time with gen ed peers and with special education peers if there is pull out. And how that looks. But all the research does support inclusive education. You're not getting pulled out to catch up, you know, and so we want to make sure that our students are just having the accommodations that they need in order to access their learning in that natural setting.
You know, Tiffany, when you talked earlier about seeing going off, you know, to college, mm-hmm. possibly as the end goal, and like working with parents about thinking about what skills that child has, yes. at that stage, how does the special education system, not place, prepare students for some of those goals and maybe not for others right now as you see it? I mean, are there things that you find yourself again and again talking to parents about, you're going to really have to fight to make sure your kid has X, Y, or Z at that end point?
I think one of the things that, you know, I've been on the school side and then on kind of the parent side of the table. And on the parent side, one of the things I have to continually talk to parents about is whether or not the child is going to go to college and what that looks like. And frequently we're talking about kids who are having learning struggles, but they also have some social emotional lessons to learn as well, and maybe some lagging executive function skills. And maybe the 4-year plan is not for them. Maybe they are the student that needs to work for a few years and then gradually go into college. So I think it's about not assuming that their child is going to follow a specific path and not assuming that the school is going to say, here is the plan for your child.
So I want to get a little bit into the struggles for schools and back to this question of what schools are legally obligated to provide, because there is this news that came out just yesterday, I believe, about the Shawnee Mission schools being cited by the state for some delayed services, some missing services. And I'm curious about, of course, this is news that no one greets happily. Is there something that can explain how oversights like that or how things like that happen? I mean, are there challenges for the schools that the layperson just doesn't understand?
May I speak?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, so a child that has an identified special need will have an individualized education program or plan, so an IEP, lots of acronyms, alphabet soup here in special education. And that document is a legal document. So parents are responsible for knowing and understanding everything outlined in that document. And that is what any lawyer would have to look at if there was an argument that the school district was not providing what was legally in that document for the child. So it sounds like some sort of investigation happened and that something was determined according to that news article. I'm sorry, I haven't read it. But
yeah,
that
for both some gifted students and some students with disabilities.
Yes, and that's what's important to understand is that if you are gifted or if you have special learning needs that are, you know, below the normal normed standard, then you will have an individualized education program. And those are basically a route map as to the services that you will be able to access in order to make adequate progress in your learning career. And as far as speaking towards that post-secondary option there, when we were talking about that, that program only covers you while you're in public school. And so then parents would have to understand what their child's service needs are when they want to think about college, because it's going to look a little different.
But this question of what are some of the challenges for schools in meeting these requirements or for school districts?
It always comes down to the staff, the bodies. I mean, if you're not able to fill all the positions that you have, then your caseloads, you might have to shift students to not their home school if you don't have somebody there to provide the services, and you'd have to send them to or propose sending them to a different school within the district to get the services that are outlined on that IEP. It really comes down to the human capital and finding people that want, that are capable, have the skill set, and are able to do the work. It can be long days.
And I think that the nature of the work with students is a factor. It can change day to day depending on what the student needs. And so we just don't staff our schools in a way to make them that flexible for, you know, we don't have a list of, oh, it's going to be a tough day. We need to call in our three people who can come in on a moment's notice.
In a perfect world, is that what you'd like to see?
Absolutely.
Let's talk with Philip, who's calling us. Philip, what do you want to share or ask?
Oh, hey there. Thanks for having me on. And I appreciate the topic of the discussion.
Thanks.
So I am a Kansas Cityan, but I work at a high school in Corvallis, Oregon, as a paraprofessional. Excuse me. And we have a kind of radically integrated program where we take our kids to wood shop and auto shop and general ed English classes. I was wondering if that is done here.
So, yeah, any sort of cutting edge stuff going on or?
Yes, I mean, that's always available here. Every school district, and based on each individualized student's needs, might structure it differently. But I am a believer that, you know, my students participate in, you know, facts class, and then a paraprofessional will go with them so that they are participating with their 7th and 8th grade peers in cooking and in sewing and participating that way. So that model is still here. Once again, paraprofessional is a support service listed on that individualized education plan that helps students access all the same activities that their peers can do, their general education peers can do.
We heard one of Tiffany's, in a perfect world, I would like the schools to be equipped with this. And in her case, it's flexible staffing where people can be called in on a moment's notice. Sarah, what is it for you?
I just want to make sure that our teachers have the resources and support of their school district and their administrators. I think that's the hardest thing, to sometimes feel that you are on your own island managing a group of students, and you can feel overwhelmed, and knowing that they can reach out and who they should reach out to, because you have a wealth of knowledge within all of your school districts. You just have to keep asking.
Well, our time is up, but keep talking to us. Tell us your stories. You can reach us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Sarah Wren Otto, Tiffany Arrington, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, our January arts show will include a profile of percussionist and vibraphone player Mike Dillon. He's a Lawrence native who's performed with everyone from Les Claypool to Ani DeFranco, and he'll be doing a show this month at the Toy and Miniature Museum. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next.